Wayne Kramer from the MC5. Nobody kicks out the jams like WBAI New York.
Each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them, a million of them. Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yes.
You start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeon. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented, I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me, I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail, I lands on his head. He flips his head, I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing south to the border down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh, Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and the kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now, you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Start off each day with a song.
He's Jimmy Durante. I'm David Rothenberg. And here's what E.E. Cummings had to say about what's happening this week. Oh, sweet, spontaneous earth, how often have the doting fingers of prurient philosophers pinched and poked thee? Has the naughty thumb of science prodded thy beauty? How often have religions take thee upon their scraggy knees, squeezing and buffeting thee, and that thou mightst conceive gods? But true to the incomparable couch of death, thy rhythmic lover, thou answerest them only with spring. Frank Lesser had his own view of this incipient season, and here's Lee Wiley's rendition of that seasonal song.
In my lonely world. continuous cold, as if to say spring will be a little slow to start, a little slow reviving that music it made in my heart. Yes, time heals all things, so I needn't cling to this fear. It's merely that spring will be a little late this year.
Young Frank Lesser wrote that haunting ballad that was introduced in a 30s movie by Deanna Durbin. Last week, in my essay that I do weekly called Out on a Limb, I said the following, that Donald Trump's best hope of achieving his goal, which is to reclaim the White House, is for an unexpected crisis to erupt. And he who provides the fast fix, the quick solution, has a head start. Wars, pandemics, climate crisis, or any unexpected crisis could turn America to Trump. And the fear is that he could induce such an event. The failures of banks fit into that category. We've had two. Financial news this morning is not encouraging. If the banks fail, we'll want a fast answer, because people will lose their life savings. And who could provide it? I'm just asking questions. We're listener-sponsored WBAI. Let me get you off on a start on two shows we have this week. And I've been talking about them in the past, and there's been a strong response, but more tickets are available. Vanities, the musical, a heartfelt and humorous chronicle of the lives of three women at the York, under the auspices of the York Theater, which has done stunning musical productions that many of us at BAI have enjoyed. The Hoagy Carmichael retrospective, the Cheek to Cheek of the Songs of Irving Berlin. This is a revival of a show which I saw 15, 18 years ago that was poignant and musically a delight. It traces these three young women from late teen years through adulthood. You meet them at first, and they are bubbly, annoying teenage Texas high school cheerleaders. But we watch the evolution. They go to college and become sorority girls and then go into adulthood and suddenly realize all of the preconceived parameters to define womanhood, and they become activists. This is the story of Vanities in musical terms. It's a musical delight. And it's based on a very successful play of the same name by a man named Jack Heifner, who also wrote the book for this musical. It's coming to the theater at St. Jean's on East 76th Street. Two pair of tickets for $50. And the money goes to listener-sponsored BAI. And you were among those first to see Vanities in the new production at the theater at St. Jean's. We have tickets this week, Tuesday through Saturday night, every night, Tuesday through Saturday night at 7:30. We have some matinees left for Saturday, March 25th at 2:30. Some matinees for Sunday, March 26th. And then the whole following week, Tuesday, March 28th through Sunday, April 2nd, with a lot of matinee tickets in that second week. $50 to BAI. And all you have to do is email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. The second show for which we have tickets, and I'm giving you early birds. Instead of getting worms, you're going to get theater tickets. I never understood that. The early bird gets the worm. Who wants worms? Maybe the early bird. The conductor. I've been offering that. It's Ishmael Reed's play, which started previews last weekend at the Theater for the New City, a political play based on the real experience of the real story, if you will, of a right-wing cabal overthrowing a progressive team of the Board of Education, a recall vote. And the first brood of BAIers went over the weekend. Not many, but I got two immediate emails. One said, wow, can I go again? And the second said, I was thrilled with this production of The Conductor at the Theater of the New City. It's one of the best shows I've ever seen. I was not familiar with Ishmael Reed. Now I'll make sure to read all of his works. I laughed and I cried. Doesn't happen that often in the theater. So I rely on you, the theatergoers, the BAI theatergoers, who take the chance and go to the early previews. Obviously, The Conductor resonated. I got two others. They weren't reviews, but saying, yes, I liked it. Same with Vanities of those who, like myself, who recall the production of many years. So $40 for two tickets for The Conductor. $50 for two tickets for the musical Vanities. The Conductor, by the way, is at the Theater for the New City on First Avenue and 10th Street. So you email me, dprfortune@hotmail.com. In the second hour, we hope to be talking to Akeem Browder, the brother of Khalif Browder, the young man whose life ended so tragically after he left Rikers Island and became the catalyst for much of that's happening on the closing of Rikers Island and bail reform. We'll be talking with his brother, Akeem, who's become a very effective and passionate advocate for change as a result of the turmoil that was inflicted on his family by a system that was irrelevant. We have a musical component to our program, and this morning the wonderful Rosemary Clooney kicks it off with a song by Doc Dougherty and A.J. Nieberg.
I'm confessing that I love you. Tell me, do you love me too? I'm confessing that I need you, honest I do. Need you every moment. In your eyes I read such strange things. but your lips deny they're true. Will your answer really change things, making me blue? I'm afraid someday you'll leave me, saying, can't we still be friends? If you go, you know you'll grieve me. All my life on you depends. Am I guessing that you love me? Dreaming dreams of you in vain. I'm confessing that I love you all over again.
Rosemary Clooney was one of those singers who just got better with age. When we first heard her, when I was in high school, she was one of those Cupid doll cuties who sang, if I knew, what did she, her big song was, Come On to My House, songs like that, catchy, but without much substance, but she gradually evolved into a lyric salesperson. She paid great attention. And as I was listening to her, I remember a story I told often about being in a taxi with a Haitian driver who was playing. First I heard Joe Williams and then I heard Rosemary Clooney. And I said, I really appreciate the music you're playing. And he said, well, they're good, but I'm not really listening to the music as much as to the way they pronounce their words, because I'm learning English through some of your good singers. He said Joe Williams and Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra and Rosemary Clooney. He said the way they pronounce words makes it much easier for me as I'm learning my English. And he had a, on his dashboard, he had two little tots, the pictures of him. And I said, are those your kids? And he said, yes, they are. And I said, I think with their daddy, they're going to have a terrific time here. I was so moved by his use of our singers as a learning tool. And I need a learning tool because I failed to give you the dates of when the conductor is playing this week at the Theater for the New City. You might be an early bird, but you might want to know when you're going. It's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8, and next Sunday at 3 for the conductor. Vanities all this week, Tuesday through Saturday night, 7:30, Saturday and Sunday matinee. And the number you call is, or the number you call, boy, am I in an anachronism? The email you send it to is dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give you a phone number and I'll call you back. In November of 1967, on the stage of the Actors Playhouse, following a performance of Fortune in Men's Eyes, which I had produced, it had opened in February of 67. And we started dialogues after the performance. Performances in March of 67, once a week on Tuesday nights. Formerly incarcerated men became participants in it as they heard about it. People started calling me, and, you know, it was the 60s when you didn't have to apologize for caring and there was activism. And people called me to have these guys who had been in prison share their stories at colleges and churches and whatnot. And we were on the circuit. And one night in November of 67, in the discussion after the performance, and a lot of the men who had been participating in the dialogues kept coming back week after week because it was therapeutic and important for them to share, not only share their stories, but to purge themselves of the rage that they were holding in. And I said, we had the nucleus of an organization and we could educate the people. And we called it the Fortune Society from the title of the play. And my little theater office on 46th Street would be the headquarters for it. I was working successfully as a theater press agent. I was representing Hair and Tennessee Williams play on Broadway and a Harold Pinter play on Broadway and Edward Albee play on Broadway and then the boys in the band off Broadway. But my theater office also would be the headquarters for this avocation, the Fortune Society. And some of the men started to agree going on radio shows, but not television, because television meant visibility to be seen, and that might endanger the jobs and the housing that they had gotten, mostly through fake names, aliases, because the punishment continued after the punishment. But four men did agree to go on the David Susskind program. little bit of water, David. And in March of 68, almost a year after the play opened, the Susskind show played. And at the end of the program, Susskind said, these four men are part of a new organization, the Fortune Society, 1545 Broadway in New York. And the next day, my little theater office was invaded by hundreds of men who had been in prison, thinking that this was a thriving, big organization that could help them to find jobs, to find housing, to deal with addiction, to deal with anger, to find out what's going on. They never heard of anything like this because there was nothing for people, for men coming out of prison. And I keep saying men because it was 2 years until the first woman came forward. And in that day, there was nothing I could do. I was a theater press agent with my theater posters, and I was arranging for formerly incarcerated men to speak at high schools and colleges, going with them and appearing on a television show. But jobs and housing, I didn't know how to respond to them. among the dozens and dozens and dozens of men who were coming in all day, two of the men, Kenny Jackson and Mel Rivers, stuck around. They saw something that meant Kenny was working as a truck driver with a fake driver's with a fake trucking license, and Melvin was a gypsy taxi driver. I don't know if he had a license or not. He'd learned how to be a barber in prison, but couldn't get a license because they didn't want a formerly incarcerated person to have scissors, though they trained him. And Melvin and Kenny became the nucleus, and the three of us for the next 3 years were the core of what became the Fortune Society, a service organization. It grew so incredibly. I eased my way out of the theater. And within 2 years, three of us went on salary at the Fortune Society at $100 a week. Kenny and Melvin gave up their jobs. We were the three representing Fortune Society that went to Attica and sat in the yard. As observers, we testified in Washington for judiciary and House committees in Albany and the City Hall. And we became a service organization as well as an advocacy organization. Grew so big that we had to move out of my theater office. I gave up all shows. We moved down to 22nd Street. By then, we had a staff of about 15 people. And it was, people keep saying you were part of history. I said, you know, when you're living your day, you don't know you're part of history. It takes 50 years. When I talk about Attica and young people, I might as well be talking about the Alamo because it's so distant and and so far away for them. Kenny Jackson and Melvin Rivers became my partners. There were many other people who came in and had important roles at the Fortune Society, but that was the beginning. Kenny died about 20 years ago, and Mel Rivers retired to Arizona. And about 3 years ago, pre-pandemic, when I last saw him, he was having some issues, and I recognized the signs of dementia. He and his wife, though, had moved to Arizona. And in the last year or two, the phone calls were more difficult, much more painful, because he was going far away. I kept trying to talk to him about things 40 years ago, and he'd respond more quickly to that. And then 15 minutes later, not remember what we were talking about. Melvin Rivers left the planet this week, on Wednesday. I got the message yesterday that he had left. His mind had left some time ago. His body joined his mind, and he left the planet. And I am left with such memories of sharing what I remember more than anything else with all the work that we did, going to Great Falls, Montana, landing on a mountaintop, a plateau on the top of a mountain, and going into that county jail in Great Falls, Montana, testifying in Washington, going to Attica in the yard. But with Melvin and Kenny, I remember more than anything else the laughs. We laughed so much. And I came to understand that one of the things that we were creating at the Fortune Society with the men and the women that were coming in is an atmosphere of trust, because they, Kenny and Melvin, shared the experiences and knew the feelings of the men and women coming in. But once they had trust, there was laughter and people wanted to be around us. And I say all of this because, you know, one of the funny things about life, here I am, I was born and raised in Teaneck, New Jersey. Melvin Rivers was a gang kid out of Bed-Stuy. And we found things, it was the laughter, that the passion about Fortune, certainly. But that we shared so much that all of the labels that that would divide us in society. Where we grew up, color. He was formerly incarcerated. I wasn't. He was black. I was white. There are so many labels that can from each other. But in the true sense of the word, Melvin was my brother. As much as any man that I've ever known, we went through it together. And he's left. And I am left with the wonderful memories of a beautiful human being who was a great man, Melvin Rivers. Let's get to some music. Here's John Legend. John Legend, one of the contemporary stars today. I always say I can listen to current popular music and be with it. So I guess it's time for me to do Out on a Limb. First, let me tell you, we have tickets, just three pair. One for Tuesday, March 21st, one for Tuesday, March 28th, and one for Tuesday, April 11th. It's a play called The Hunting Gun. It's at the Bereznikov Center on West 37th Street. Bereznikov is in it. It's in Japanese with simultaneous translation going on. And I think the excitement of it is that Bereznikov he's miming his performance. And just to see, I think the urgency or the excitement about going to see Bereznikov move, just to watch him move, as he will in The Hunting Gun, this Tuesday and then the following Tuesday and then April 11th, one pair each. It's $60 for two tickets for BAI. It's obviously for that someone, for the some ones who have a sense of theater exploration. Although we go to foreign movies. Oh, I saw a good one, a French movie yesterday. I'll talk to you about that a little later, called The Innocent at the IFC. In French with subtitles, and this, The Hunting Gun with simultaneous translation at the Bereznikov Center. One pair for this Tuesday, then the following Tuesday, The Hunting Gun. All right, out on a limb, an essay I do weekly. Little water. A few days ago, Mayor Eric Adams' casual response to a question created a tremor throughout the city, hitting a high note on the political Richter scale. His much-quoted statement was, "Don't tell me about no separation of church and state. We have an administration that doesn't believe in that." After a ruckus and perhaps some sage counsel from associates and protests from the NYCLU, the mayor slowly backtracked. Although, read the papers today, and the backtracking is not so much back as sidetracking. The most startling aspect of this mini drama is that the mayor doesn't seem to have a full comprehension of the historic implications of his initial statement. Separation of church and state is a concept sacrosanct to many, certainly deep in my heart and soul. This nation was conceived by beings in flight from religious tyranny, when and where the state and the church were one and the same. In recent times, oily salesmen hiding behind veils of sanctimony have attempted to impose their political and social beliefs wrapped in religious ribbons. Let me cut to the chase about a modern political triangle of duplicity, with religion as the hypotenuse. Follow the money. It's about being eligible for local, state, and federal funding. It's about tax exemption status, and it's often used to put a kind face on ugly social positions and stances. It has little or nothing to do with faith or people's private relationship with their identified supreme being. Faith is real, a vital component in the lives of many Americans. I don't underestimate it, nor do I minimize it. In many instances, it's an emotional safety net. I applaud, marvel, sometimes envy my friends who have this deep religious conviction. And at its best, it offers serenity, purpose, and assurance. I've gathered with, argued with, and embraced men and women of various denominations, Jesuit priests, Buddhists, Muslims, Quakers, Baptists, Unitarians, Episcopalians, and I assure you, you can't identify them without a scorecard. And of course, I have been influenced and surrounded by Jews and by my grandma Adelaide's Christian Science. Millions for whom religion provides a moral guideline, a sense of being, and often manifests itself in great acts of kindness. The Bible, the Quran, Torah, and most scriptures of faith are more embracing than their interpreters. I see myself half inside the religious tent, half outside. I have more questions than answers about religion's role or place on this planet and its views on the alleged aftermath. Saying all that, discussion about separation of church and state is not really about religion or faith. It's about funding and religious restrictions, freedom for selected demographics. That conflict has inflicted itself profoundly and absurdly in American life. Deep in my twilight years, as I am, I remain filled with wonderment about life's mysteries. Childbirth, the autumn leaves, puppy dogs, and our inability to determine the beginning of this amazing galaxy. Some attribute it all to God, their God, and have built shrines to honor that unknown being and kneel in awe of the majesty that is the Earth's beauty and the unknowns. Because I do not share that same conviction, it does not mean I lack faith. I merely don't need rituals to define my faith, which I find mostly in the human spirit. Do you recall in the film Sounder, set in the South in the 1930s, and the young boy David asks why he, a black youth, cannot enter the white church? And an elder responds, David, God's been asking that same question for years. And in modern times, a Colorado baker wouldn't bake a cake for two men getting married because it offended his religious beliefs. Two very different examples, one affecting millions, the other two lives. But the mathematics aside, it's the same principle. Religions are tempting and sometimes succeeding in limiting freedom with government complicity. Mayor Adams must learn that the churches of the nation were partners to the politics that permitted slavery and segregation. And since our nation's inception, we have been a country advocating separation of church and state, encouraging people of faith, but not having their religion impose itself, mainly asking for money and tax breaks, and defining who can be included. This does not prevent anyone from pursuing their beliefs. That we know from history that religions with the state power have ostracized, imprisoned, or killed people of different faiths. My government cannot, must not allow your religious beliefs to limit my participation in our experiment with democracy, nor should my lack of definable religion be a barrier for you. Like my grandma said when the kids went outside, just play nice and don't fight. David Rothenberg, out on a limb. And I want to point out that this week, after all of the ruckus, the mayor has said that this is a city of God. And at the same time, he was talking about prolonging the closing of Rikers Island. I would like to suggest that Mayor Adams invite God or the interpreters of God to come into Rikers Island and see if this is a place that expresses the greatness that and the beauty that emanates from the image of God. I'm asking questions. Here's Roberta Flack. Thank you. Roberta Flack. Do you believe in miracles? Here's two. Dear David, this is an email this morning. Can't believe it. I get WBAI 99.5 live and here, and I heard out on a limb on my phone, 38 hours on the Atlantic, sailing to the Azores in Lisbon from our deck, the moment's view, taken with the phone that's listening to you. Stay well, Connie. Hello, Atlantic Ocean. The second miracle, Fairleigh Dickinson College. This is what's now Fairleigh Dickinson University. I grew up, it was a little college down on the river, the Hackensack River. This is March Madness. And last night, the 16th seeded Fairleigh Dickinson University defeated top seeded Purdue. If you don't follow basketball, 64 teams are in the NCAA playoff. There are four brackets. Each bracket has a seeding from 1 to 16. And in the opening round, which was Thursday and Friday, the 16th-ranked team played the one-ranked teams. And, of course, traditionally, through the 100 years of NCAA, only once before has a 16th-ranked team ever defeated a number one-ranked team. And FDU did it, and they're dancing in the streets in Teaneck, New Jersey. I don't know who they'll be playing. They're down now to 32 teams, and today and tomorrow it'll go down to 16. I'll have to figure out who Fairleigh Dickinson's will be playing tomorrow, but that's a miracle. People have been accused of things, and I have reactions. You know, I've always recalled Al Franken's resigning from the Senate based on an allegation, and I thought it was too soon, and he never had a hearing, and I thought it was unfortunate. That doesn't mean we're indifferent to allegations made by women about male abuse, which has been seemed to be pro forma, but a couple of things have come up. Queen Assemblyman Juan Adelia has been pressured to resign. Accusations of sexual misconduct in 2015 when he was a college student at Fordham. And he has admitted that he's guilty of the sexual presumption. It wasn't a rape. It was one was exposing himself and the other kissing a woman without permission while they were all drunk. Not defensible acts. Certainly the behavior of college boys who are not guided by sensitivity and awareness of no means no, or whatever the parameters are, not taking advantage. Should he resign? It would happened while he was in college. Who has he been since? Does he, you know, there are all sorts of questions. Donald Trump has been accused of rape, of assaulting many, many women, of that insidious tape about grabbing women's genitalia, and got elected president. That doesn't make what this young man did 8 years ago right, but I'm not sure if I don't want punishment to be our only way of solving problems and enlightening men about how to behave around women. Anyway, I've put that forward. I'm not ready for him to resign. I want to hear more of what he has to say about what he did and who he is now. Who he is now has to include forgiveness of what he did then. If you can buy that. I'm not asking you to agree with me. I'm expressing my sentiments. The other is John Morant, who's a great basketball player in the NBA, a young real star with Memphis, who was seen on Instagram. I don't even know if you're seen on Instagram if you hear it. And he had a gun. And he's been taken to task and he's been punished. Eight game banishment that he can't play for Memphis when they're coming down the stretch in the drive for the championship. I understand that. All right, eight games. He's not going to be playing. He's being punished for that. Is anyone sitting and talking to him about, here he is, a 23-year-old, suddenly with a contract worth millions and millions of dollars. Athletes and big money at a young age, before you're totally formulated as a man, can be give you a sense of entitlement. And athletes get a free pass from grammar school on. I had a friend who was in the NFL, and he said starting in the eighth grade, because he could run faster, throw farther, and tackle harder than anybody else, he was given the keys to the kingdom. He was the kid on the dais at the Rotary Club Christmas dinner in high school, free passage to college. And then you go in the pros and you get the big money and you're wined and dined, and suddenly they're giving you parameters. Somebody has to sit down with John Morant, who I've seen on interviews, seems like a nice, bright young man. Punishment is not the only path. There has to be some intervention, some illumination that goes with it, so that we're not making martyrs out of people, but making them aware of miscreant behavior and having them move forward in understanding in their lives. It's complicated. Let's hear from, shall we hear from Simon and Garfunkel? And then, Sean, maybe we can try and reach Akeem Browder while they're playing. All right. Simon and Garfunkel.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Every day is an endless stream of cigarettes and magazines. And each town looks the same to me, the movies and the factories, and every stranger's face I see reminds me that I long to be homeward bound. I wish I tonight I'll sing my songs again, I'll play the game and pretend. Mm-hmm. But
But all my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity, like emptiness and harmony. I need someone to comfort me. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts escape, and home, where my music's playing. Silently for me.
That's Simon and Garfunkel singing Homeward Bound, and I didn't intend that to be an intro for you, Akeem, but you're now in Anaheim, California, and you're homeward bound because you're coming here next Sunday to speak at the Ethical Culture Society next Sunday at 11 o'clock, and I'm going to be there to hear you. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Of course I can. I've been hearing you for years.
Good morning. Good morning.
I know it's 6 o'clock there. I appreciate your getting up so early to talk to us. When you come to Ethical Culture next Sunday, you'll be talking about a lot of what you and I have talked about over the years. I want to, your brother Khalif, after he took his life, it became the catalyst for dramatic change in this city. The whole movement to close Rikers Island for bail reform started with the story in The New Yorker about Khalif. I think, if I may, Akeem, could you tell us about who was Khalif and tell us about your family?
Yes, thanks. Thank you for the opportunity to bring not just this story, but, you know, Khalif, just like everyone else that grows up in New York, he was a kid from the Bronx. And in the Bronx, we don't really, I liken it to, you know, you don't really know poverty that much. If it's like, if you're growing up in it, you know what it is, but you don't really feel it till you see the difference or the contrast, you know? So we made do with what we had. So we had brothers, we had lots of family members. My mother adopted us and brought us into her home. We didn't know we were adopted. And so we just had a huge family. We actually had, my mother foster cared 32 kids. And Khalif was the youngest and the last adopted kid that my mom took in. So we all grew up just knowing we're brothers and family. And he was playful as a kid. And he liked Yu-Gi-Oh! He liked things that kids like Yu-Gi-Oh! Dragon Ball. I mean, we grew up in a household that we all thought we were Dragon Ball characters. And so, yeah, Khalif was just a youthful young man, or young boy, because before anything, he was only 16 when he was taken into Rikers Island. But you know, he was just like every other kid. People make mistakes here and there. I don't even think it's mistakes. I think it's just life lessons that we learn. And so if you do something and you're accused of something, so Khalif, you know, he did have one run-in with the law prior to his arrest, which he was joyriding with his friends in a bread truck that they got into, and he was stopped because he was a passenger in the bread truck, and he was stopped. And when he stopped because they crashed. Actually, they not even into a car. It was into the curb. They didn't know how to drive. They were just kids. But we all make mistakes, and we learn from it. Unfortunately, his mistake cost him to have a felony probation as a 15-year-old. And then the next time he was arrested, which was this wrongful allegation, he already had a record, unfortunately. So yeah, this is what he started his young adulthood life with, and I don't.
The thing that's so startling about the story of Khalif is that he was arrested for stealing a backpack, and that bail couldn't. The bail was about $500, and he wouldn't cop a plea because he said he didn't take it. And so that he did more, he did almost 3 years on Rikers Island. He did more time than people who have been convicted of serious crimes. And I think that's part of why bail reform became an issue, because the absurdity of him being held that long just because he came from a family didn't have the money to bail him out. And that made you an activist as a result. Had you been involved in anything before the senselessness of Khalif's story?
Actually, I have. I myself actually was wrongfully incarcerated twice in my life. Unfortunately, you know, the statistic is one in every three Black people are stopped by police or will have a police encounter. And that statistic was true for my family. I was the first one in my family arrested, and then Khalif was the second. But I started my activism shortly after 2009, which was for Ban the Box. Ban the Box, if you know that piece of legislation, was something that was really actually progressive to start, which to stop people from having to check off that box when you're applying for a job that says, hey, if before you even are interviewed, were you a convicted felon, or do you have a felony record? And then that just, you know, prohibits you from even moving forward. And so, yeah, I was a part of that that movement, and I could recall, like, fighting for it. But I wasn't really active that much. I wasn't vocal. I thought after my wrongful arrest that, you know, you just get up and keep on moving. You just go get a job, and you have to just continue trying to be a part of society that casts you away. You know, the rhetoric of being arrested is, if you did the crime, you do the time. That kind of just means, like, I guess, the people that, you know, you're due for whatever you get, whatever happens when you get arrested. That's your fault. And, you know, arrest is when you're accused, and when you're in jail, it's when you're accused of being of doing something against the law. But it doesn't mean you actually did it. So people should realize that arrest just means you're accused of something. You're not actually guilty, and it doesn't matter. You should be innocent until proven guilty. You shouldn't have to fight for your, the state has the obligation to prove you did something wrong.
And the reports on Khalif's doing time is that he had a very tough time. He tried to take his life and then was punished by being in solitary as a result of that. Is that what happened?
Yeah, Khalif, unfortunately, when he, Rikers took a huge toll on anyone. It takes a huge toll on anyone.
Was Khalif, he little? What was his frame, his size?
Yeah.
I got the impression that he was little or thin.
He was shorter than you, David.
Well, that's really short.
So, no, Khalif, when he was 16, his stats, he was 100. 30 to 40 pounds, and he was only 5'4", going on 5'5". He wasn't that big. But, you know, it got worse, because even with that stature, that frame, you know, when you're in Rikers, you can't, it stunts your growth. First of all, that's traumatic. That's a traumatic experience, because now you're fighting, you're scared, you're out of your environment. You're put into a place that you know of because you heard of it in the news. You hear of it from your friends who had friends that were arrested. You're experiencing something that you kind of wish you never had, although you know that this this happens and you might be caught up in the same system. Because in the black community, this is almost like a rite of passage. It's almost like a, hey, this is what we all go through, especially stop and frisk. Even though people probably don't know stop and frisk because they say they stopped that process, stop and frisk was prevalent. Khalif would go to school and the teachers would actually joke about, all right, who was stopped today? And so Khalif ended up, you know, getting stopped. He was stopped before stop and frisk, and it just never led to anything. But this time, when he was actually stopped and accused of something and being on Rikers, you know, it's a shock. You think you're going to go to the precinct. You know, you didn't do anything. And so you're going to go to the precinct. They're going to realize you didn't do anything. And you just go home.
And was he beaten up there, though? Was he physically abused while I was on Rikers?
So Khalif got into massive amounts of fights because he's not gang affiliated. And so usually Rikers is notorious for having Bloods, the gang Bloods. And, you know, if you're in that housing unit and you're not a Blood, they try to pull it out. What are you? Because you have to be in. You're black. You're young. You have to be in some kind of gang. And so Khalif wasn't. And they said, you know, you're not really allowed to live, basically, if you're not in one of those gangs. Because they want that housing unit, at least those people in the unit, the other detainees, want it to stay a Blood house. And so Khalif would get into a lot of fights, and they would just pick on him because he's small. And Khalif stands up for himself. So that's just a combination for your problem, and we don't want you here.
So when he finally did come out, how much time was it before he took his life, and what was he like when he came out, and your relationship with him at that time?
Well, I want to take a step back.
Go ahead.
When he was in solitary, so he did do 3 years, not almost 3 years. He did do 3 years wrongfully incarcerated, which is painful. I mean, you know you're innocent. But in that 3 years, just to rewind it for the listeners, you know, in those 3 years, he was tortured, meaning beaten. He was starved. Khalif reported every 4 days he wouldn't have a meal. For 4 days he wouldn't have a meal in solitary, because he would do things like complain that he needed a shower, or he would complain that he needed to speak to a therapist. Well, when you're in solitary, you need a therapist. You need a counselor to help guide you through the thoughts in your head. That's torturing you, the sounds that you're hearing on the outside, outside of yourself. And they would just laugh it off. They would even watch Khalif attempt suicide. He would attempt to hang himself. And the guard, we've seen it on video, they would just stand in front of his cell and laugh. And then wait until he had enough, they said, and then cut him down.
That's Akeem, I want to interject here. That's the thing is that when a young man, 17, 16, 17, attempts to take their life, what needed at the very least is intensive therapy and an ear to listen, somebody to listen to. And that Rikers Island punishes people who have tried to take their lives. That becomes a punishment reason rather than intervening. That's one of the things that we keep talking about, why Rikers is so horrendous, because at point of crisis with young people, they're left, well, they're punished. it almost validates their reason for trying to take their life. It's unbearable.
I was there.
I've visited solitary and Rikers many times and talked in the juvenile unit and talking to them and hearing the tears and the fear and the panic. It's horrible. It's an experience witnessing it is horrible.
David, it's also a different experience when you're going in as an observer and when you're living there.
Of course, it's different.
And I was in solitary confinement, and those guards, they make it seem like you're making their shift hard, so they will punish you. Like they tell you, I don't want to have to do no paperwork today. So don't F with me. And so anything happens, you will be tortured for it. They will even, they set up things. Khalif even stated to everyone that the guards are the ones that's the problems here. The people in here has got issues, but the guards are amping it up. They're hyping it up. And they can create situations. And so when Khalif, when he attempted suicide, they created that situation. They created a kid who never had mental illness to have mental illness. And we're saying the term young man, but by any means, a 16-year-old is still a kid. And so when Khalif came home, and the family actually, when he came home, we didn't recognize him, not just physically, but the things he talked about. And that's for my family who's never been incarcerated. It was only me and Khalif that understood each other really closely, because after that experience, you realize the world is a lie, at least for what's told, that, you know, police are there to protect you. And police, like every average American who's never been arrested, we already know that we assume that the police, when you get arrested, you should let them know, hey, because you're innocent. Hey, I was over here, or I didn't do this because I was with this person. You automatically start talking. We should realize that, no, for some reason they should be trusted, but they can't. So we should realize the law. Any attorney would tell you, do not talk to the police when you're arrested. Let your attorney represent.
Akeem, so when Khalif came home, he was going to go to college, but how long did he stay home before he took his life? And could you see it coming?
When Khalif came home, actually, he got his GED on the first try. He took the test. He wanted to catch up with society. He took the test, passed it on the first try, and literally signed up for college, which was at BCC, Bronx Community College. After that, Khalif stayed home. He was almost a year. And so he kept a 3.6 GPA. He was going to school, great attendance, trying to be like a normal member of society. But he was also arrested twice, wrongfully. Again, they were just trying to bring him back because he had this lawsuit, this major lawsuit, where we started talking about it. He was getting interviews, and everyone was taken to Khalif. His story was just heartbreaking. And yet he was rearrested while he was in school. They said he had a fight, but meanwhile, it turned out him and a person had a verbal dispute in class. That's it. But they arrested him, which caused more trauma. Khalif was already thinking, hey, they're going to put me back in jail. They're going to try and kill me this time. And so Khalif had a lot of mental illness because of the fear, the panic that bred multiple personality disorder. And so Khalif actually started talking to himself. He started realizing that no one's going to listen to me. This is what happens when you're in solitary. No one's going to listen to me, so I got to develop something or someone to listen to me. And so Khalif would talk to himself and let himself know that the system is wrong. This has got to change, but they're not going to change. They're going to keep on coming at you. And Khalif would talk like this out loud. And people just think that, you know, you're crazy. You're not crazy. You have trauma. And so Khalif, when he was home, even though he was trying to make it, he was fighting those, what he called, demons that was in his head.
And this must have been, for your mother, must have been an ordeal of great proportions.
My mom had to watch her son walk the four corners of the front yard, thinking that he was so that he would walk the four corners of the garage, the front yard, and that was what he considered recreation. Sad, the things that he came back was normal because of that trauma. That was recreation, or
he recreated the prison environment
outside in a free world. He would come home from school and go upstairs in his room like he was locking in, and people didn't realize, or they heard his story because we did the documentary Time, the Khalif Brown story, and the pain. Yeah, it's hard to realize, it's hard to watch, but we have to realize there's a lot of exonerated people. What are we doing to aid in their mental illness? the sickness that was derived from the prison environment, the culture, the abuse. We have to do more for people.
I wonder how you and the family feels. He went through this. You witnessed this horrendous experience and the transition and the dissolvement, and he has become the symbol for change. It's rather extraordinary. You must, at one point, you think it memorializes. It gives a truth to his life, but yet he had to go through all of that for him to become the symbol or the catalyst or the cry for meaningful change. It must leave you rather torn with emotions.
Yeah, you know, Khalif, even though Khalif presented a window of opportunity for change to happen, I mean, there was a time period that the window was open for us to make change, for us to push legislation, for us to educate, for people to empathize. But on the personal level, my family has never been the same, because my mom, unfortunately, through the fight after Khalif passed away, the fight, which you shouldn't have to fight, but my mom, she died from the fight. She died from a broken heart, watching her son go through all this. He didn't get to have he never got a girlfriend, so he didn't have a normal life, you know, like acclimation into becoming a teenager. He never got the chance to socialize and be a part of society. He didn't get to graduate from high school. And so he got stripped from all this. And my mom, the guilt for thinking I shouldn't have let him go to this birthday party. People probably don't even realize that my mom, she had guilt because that day that he was arrested, she had let him go to his first birthday party, like not his, but a friend's birthday party. And she never really let us out the house. And so you had to be 18 before you leave, like to have some kind of freedom. And so when she let him at 16 go to this birthday party and never came home because of this incident, she blamed herself. That kind of guilt for assuming that, you know, you did this to him. You shouldn't have let him out. And she ended up having a heart attack after he took his life. You know, he took his life in my mom's house, and it was only her and him in the house.
It's a story. There's so many stories of families, but your family really has become a symbol. Akeem, we're going to see you next Sunday. I hope a lot of our listeners will come to see you at Ethical Culture. Why did you move to California? You have a son now, and you indicated to me when we spoke that that's part of the reason. Did you just want to get out of New York? Because you were in the middle of the fight here.
Yeah. I mean, the fight started, I mean, pretty much when Khalif was arrested. That was 2010. And it's already, I just moved the end of 2022, because that fight led me to realize, you know, it's taking its toll on us. My family, my mom passed, my family without a mother, the head of the family, in most families that have a single parent, when they're taken away, everyone scatters and tries to stay together. But then I also didn't want my son to become a part of a statistic. New York is known for its black young men to be put in jail, in Rikers and jails like Rikers. I mean, we have a boat that people don't even know of. We have jails all over New York City, even just disguised as buildings. I didn't want my son to grow up in that culture. However, I'm still back and forth in New York with the Khalif Browder Foundation, which, I mean, I just didn't want to live in it. But while my son is going through this, childhood and upbringing, but it also got violent in New York because the way that, you know, laws is manipulated. We're trying to pass legislation to help people, and, you know, our bills are getting rolled back after being passed, and it's a shame that that Rikers is still open, even though the mayor stated that he was going to close it.
Well, that was Mayor de Blasio. Mayor Adams is backtracking. What's your son's name?
His name is Raphael Ethan Browder.
How old is he?
He's only 5 years old.
Is he coming with you next Sunday? Will I see him?
I wish. He actually, he wants everyone to come to California. He tells me all the time. He's like, I'm like, hey, you want to come back to New York? He's like, no, can you bring them to, like, my friends to California?
So we're not going to meet Raphael. I had a chance to speak to him on the phone last week. I think he's 44 going on, or 5 going on 40. He sounded like a very self-possessed young man.
Yes. No, he's, you know what? I want him to stay and grow up with a childhood instead of, like, believing that he's older than he is. Like, I think every kid or every person, male or female or whatever you identify as, should grow up as with a childhood and not try to rush to adulthood. So I'm giving him that opportunity. I don't let him do anything that makes him seem like, if he talks, because I'm a talker, and so he gets that from me.
He chatted with me very comfortably. Here I am, a stranger, 3,000 miles away. You put him on the phone, and he went off. He just started chatting with me. It was adorable, adorable.
Yeah.
Akeem, you're going to be at Ethical Culture 2 West 64th Street next Sunday. I hope you call me beforehand and we can see each other before or after that. And I'll let you go. Go back to sleep. It's the crack of dawn in California.
It's 6:30 almost over here.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to seeing you next Sunday, my friend.
Good second, everyone.
Okay. Thank you, Akeem Browder. Next Sunday, 11 o'clock, Ethical Culture Society, 2 West 64th Street. I will be there. I hope to see you to support the Akeem Browder Foundation and the work that they're doing, and he can guide us on the things that have to be done. From the Broadway musical Seesaw, here's Tommy Toon. This might be an appropriate song at this point. It's not where you start. It's where you finish.
He liked it. He liked it. He really liked it. He said, would you be interested in being the assistant choreographer of my new Broadway show? And I said, I'm not really interested in being an assistant choreographer. I'm lying. I'm lying. I'm lying. I really said interested. Interested? Would I be interested? Wow! Well, it's the beginning. It's not where you start, it's where you finish. It's not how you go, it's how you land. 100-1 shot, you call him a klutz. Can outrun the favorite, all he needs is the guts. Your final return will not diminish. And you can be the cream of the crop. It's not where you start, it's where you finish. And you're gonna finish on top.
It's where you start, it's where you
finish. It's not where you start, it's where you
finish.
It's
not how you go, it's how you land.
It's not how you go, it's how you land. Your final return will not diminish.
Final return will not diminish.
And you can be the cream of the crop.
It's not where you start, it's where you finish. And you're gonna finish on top. If you start at the top, you're certain to drop. You've got to watch your timing. Better begin by climbing up, up, up the ladder. If you're going to last, you can't make it fast. Man, nobody starts a winner. Give me a slow beginner.
Rock after rock after rock after rock after rock after rock after rock.
Tommy Tune danced it, and Michael Bennett choreographed it, and it was Theater Magic, Seesaw, a musical version of William Gibson's play, Two for the Seesaw. It's opened, if you want to come next Sunday at 11 o'clock, to Ethical Culture, but they're showing the movie about Kalief Browder later that day in the afternoon. For that, you have to sign up. So go to ethical.nyc and sign up for the movie about Kalief Browder and what Akeem was telling about his brother. Akeem's quite a young man. I'm fond of him, and hearing about his family and his mom and what they went through has been, the word isn't an inspiration. Inspiration is a motive, reason to stay involved, to get, because when he talks about Kalief, you just see this kid and it's a wasted life. And when I go to Fortune, I see so many versions and editions of Kalief in the alternatives to incarceration program. I'm so glad that so many of our young men and women, that there are alternative programs now that they can go into that they don't have to go to Rikers, but not enough. Not enough get in, and the forces of ignorance are still campaigning. They're making bail reform seem like the cause of crime, which it isn't. It's complicated and infuriating. We have theater tickets for you. I announced earlier that we have tickets this coming week for the conductor Ishmael Reed's play about, based on the true experience of what happened in San Francisco when a group of a right-wing, well-funded right-wing cabal enacted a recall of the Board of Education, which was progressive and represented diversity in the community. It's in a play called The Conductor, and of course, it's at the Theater for the New City down on First Avenue. And we never know when we're doing a preview of how a play is, and I told you, if you tuned in earlier, last weekend, to the first two people that went to see it, the first one said, "Wow, can I go again?" And the second person wrote, "I was thrilled with that production of The Conductor at the Theater for the New City. It's one of the best shows I've ever seen. I wasn't familiar with Ishmael Reed. Now I'm going to read all of his work. I laughed and I cried. That doesn't happen often in the theater." The Conductor. Theater for the New City, 1st Avenue and 10th Street. $40 to BAI for two tickets, Thursday the 23rd, Friday the 24th, Saturday the 25th, all at 8 o'clock, Sunday the 26th, 3 o'clock. We also have tickets for this week coming up for The Black That I Am at the Here Arts Center. It's the work of... it's a creation by Carl O'Brien Williams. it was inspired by a poem of that name, The Black That I Am, and it's questioning themes of gender, sexuality, nationalism, exploring what it means to be Black, Jamaican, and a foreign immigrant, an experience that can both be empowering and disempowering. It's called The Black That I Am. It's at the Here Arts Center down on 6th Avenue, right in Soho. We have tickets for that next Friday and Saturday night, and next Saturday and Sunday matinee. That's also $40 for two tickets. All you have to do for all these shows is email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give your phone number. I'll call you back, and we'll arrange for you to get to the theater. I have movie, play, and book reviews. Book review, Bill Schweigert's The Guilty One, published by Crooked Lane Books, is as much an experience as it is a work of fiction to read. Alexandra, Virginia detective Cal Farrell is the hero cop of a town-shattering mass shooting, and in the tidy, understated first half of Mr. Schweigert's adventure, we gain insight of officers Farrell's inner turmoil and understandable aftermath of a tragic and violent experience. That's all a setup for a sudden series of messy acts that occur. Farrell is falsely suspected of crimes he's investigating, which leads to a series of ferocious escapades. It's a whirlwind of adventure amidst sinister people. Some fellow police officers are judgmental and dangerous in their miscalculations. The Guilty One is a roller coaster ride for Detective Farrell and for the reader. He's in pursuit of the truth, and he pulls us along with us. Happy landing, everyone. At the movies, I told you last week, opened yesterday for a week at the Film Forum, is Ken Loach's Spirit of 45, a documentary that explains the British transition, the social implementation, particularly of a national health program after World War II, when soldiers came back from war wanting to know why they were coming back to poverty in a Charles Dickens-like England. And they fought for change, and they got a lot of change. Margaret Thatcher undid it in great, great numbers, but couldn't get rid of the National Health Plan. People are holding on to that. We see it happening here with the mild Obamacare program, which Trump wanted to dismantle. But the other movie that I saw is called The Innocent, and it's at the IFC. It's a French movie. It's so unlike any other caper movie. There's a heist. I don't want to tell you. Give too much of it away. I was constantly surprised. That's why I don't want to give it away, because it's unpredictable. It's charming. It's funny. It's serious. It's called The Innocent. It's from France. It's at the IFC Theater. You just have to take my word for it. And if you don't like it, you can yell at me. And usually with the theater, I see a lot of theater, and I review those that I think I want to recommend. And sometimes I decide to review a play because of the implications of it, even if I didn't like it. Thus, Henrik Ibsen's 19th century drama ignited protests and heated discussions around the world. A Doll's House. The Norwegian playwright's protagonist, Nora Helma, walked out of her home and slammed the door. It's often cited as the opening round of women's liberation. Ibsen's theme and characters have echoed continuously. Numerous plays and films are indebted to Ibsen's fervor. The Men Theatre's recent presentation of Betty Smith's 1930 play Becomes a Woman and the Oscar-nominated film Women Talking are only two productions that echo Ibsen's Nora. Director Jamie Lloyd's production of Amy Herzog's Tinkering with Ibsen's text tends to obliterate the very essence and historic significance of A Doll's House. Nora sits on a chair throughout. Her sole movement is when the turntable begins to spin. All the cast members are in somber black outfits. The lights are dim. The actor's enunciation at times is rushed or unclear. There's no color and no home for Nora to leave. and hardly a reason for her to stay. It didn't work for me at all. Many of the scenes reminded me of acting classes I witnessed at the HB studios. As presented, this Doll's House seems more appropriate for radio than for the stage. Jessica Chastain, a lovely and gifted screen actress, could hardly be the radio star, though, since her voice lacks the timbre that reveals Nora's grit. Think of a Julie Harris or Judi Dench or Rosemary Harris, women with voices that command attention. Directors are free to reconceptualize play, but the efforts here are misguided. We need to see the home and the dress of Ibsen's Norway, and Miss Chastain needed them as props. A turntable hinting movement can provide theatrical daring, but when it sabotages the core of the playwright's theme, it is more than frustrating. A Doll's House should send the audience out of the theater marching in protest. At the Hudson, I was not inspired. In fact, I was bored. Here's Rosemary Clooney with a David Fishberg song that I find delightful.
Am I hopelessly old-fashioned? 'Cause I'm harboring a passion for the olden days. Is my sense of time so out of joint? It's starting to distort my point of view. Does my antiquarian brain contain imaginary memories of golden days? Can one feel a real nostalgia for a time and place one never even knew? I anticipate times to come with something less than jubilation. And I'm turning to times gone by with something more and more like admiration. Here's to the dear departed past, the musty magazines, the sepia-tinted scenes of long-forgotten places. Here's to the dear departed past, the photographs you find that seem to call to mind familiar family faces. That's when every sky was bluer. Clouds seemed to disappear back then. That's when every friend was truer. Ah, but then again, didn't they know you when? Here's to the folks who live next door. Let's cut across the yard. Drop in and leave a card with neighborly affection. Here's to the ways we see no more. The manner and the style that makes you want to smile in happy retrospection. For me, I'll forget about the future, 'cause the future fades away too fast. Now's the time to lift a cup of cheer and say, here, here, for the dear departed past. Here's to the sides we used to spin, the Deccas and Savoys, with all the surface noise, the Lindy Hops and Foxtrots. Here's to the orphan Annie Pin, the secret squadron ring the mailman used to bring for a quarter and some box tops. Music on the uke was easy. E7 always went to A. Chinese checkers and Parcheesi. And every Saturday, the movie matinee. I love the 55 Bel Air, the 37 Fords, complete with running boards and rumble seats and fenders. Where are the clothes we used to wear? Now don't forget your tie and button up your fly and fasten your suspenders. As for me, I don't think about tomorrow, 'cause tomorrow wasn't built to last. Now's the time to weep a little tear into your beer for the dear departed past. Three cheers for the champs of yesterday: Jack Dempsey, John McGraw, Joe Louis, Sammy Baugh, the movers and the shakers. And here's to the teams that moved away from disenfranchised towns: the old St. Louis Browns, the Minneapolis Lakers. That's when basketballs had laces and halfbacks played safety on defense. That's when there were parking places, hot dog for a dime, White Castle, 7 cents. And here's to White Castles by the sack. I heard somebody say they're still around today, but they wouldn't taste the same now. Here's to the years that won't be back, the days that dodged away and left us here to play a completely different game now. But here's to the echoes of tomorrow, soon to be memories at last. Memories that will someday reappear loud and clear in the dear departed past. Memories that will someday reappear loud and clear in the dear departed past.
Rosemary Clooney singing a Dave Frischberg song. How many people can identify Sammy Baugh? People in the news. Well, Donald Trump is in the news. Apparently he's coming here to get arrested, turn himself in, sort of, maybe. I've seen stories hinting that the machinery will begin to demonize New York Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, first African-American DA in Manhattan's history. Pay close attention. Alvin Bragg is a man of dignity, of intelligence. We are fortunate to have a man of his quality as district attorney. I sat in a room and met with him for several hours. I am very impressed by his integrity and his decency, and that he's smart. And he's going to be he's going to be very rough for him, because Trump is going to get indicted this week, it seems. And while we're on the same track, Rosa Parks is no longer black in Florida, in Governor DeSantis' Florida. The social studies books have rewritten Rosa Parks' place in history, and there's no longer mention of race. Didn't Godfrey Cambridge make a movie called Watermelon Man? Did he go from white to black, or white, black to white? That's what's happening. But you know what's interesting? This may get so much attention, the absurdity of it, that it might bring more focus on Rosa Parks' historic role than would otherwise be given. Because young people don't pay that much attention to history. History is not a popular subject. And Rosa's loss of blackness may prompt more discussion than if she would remain black in the Florida school social studies books. Ay, 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 ay. And James Dolan, the Donald Trump of Manhattan, head of Madison Square Garden, has prevented hundreds of people through, what is that called, his policy of racial recognition. Anybody that's involved with a law firm that represents a client that's suing the Garden is not getting in. And as a result, the state liquor authority started to determine if this is a reason to pull their liquor license, because it's a violation of state law to ban people based on some invidious distinction. And Trump, there was a the, Trump, Dolan had Charles Stravell, a state liquor authority investigator who was assigned to investigate the Garden. He realized he was being trailed in his car going out to Long Island because of the work that he was doing. James Dolan thinks he's above the law, and he's made Madison Square Garden the world's most famous arena, an embarrassment. And that's what I have to say about that. We have Tickets for Vanities, a musical that just exploded on the scene 15 years ago, a musical version of a play that was very successful, following three young women through high school and college and going from bubbly, cheerleaded teenagers into young women who know and recognize the trials and tribulations of their gender. It's all done with music, and it's delightful. And I, when I saw it 15 years ago, I was a great champion of Vanities. The wonderful York Theatre Company is giving it a second viewing. They did the Hoagie Carmichael retrospective, and they did the Irving Berlin Cheek to Cheek. They are now sponsoring Vanities at the theater at St. Jean's on East 76th Street. We have a $50 gift to WBAI and gets you two tickets to a musical. We have tickets all this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night at 7:30. Saturday and Sunday at 2:30, and then the whole following next week, Tuesday the 28th through Sunday, April 2nd, with matinee tickets on Saturday, April 1st, and Sunday, April 2nd. We're into April, children. We're getting there. I guess we're near the end. Well, let's hear from John Legend, and then we'll figure out if we have any time to say goodbye before, well, before anything. Here's John Legend. He's in heaven.
Way back. start to dance.
John Legend, that's him, not me. I'm David Rothenberg. Before I leave, and thanking you for joining this morning, sharing, listening to Keem Browder. Hope I see you next Sunday at Ethical Culture. I want to remind you that we have theater tickets, which enables you to support our station and for you to enrich yourself with New York's wonderful cultural variations. Just got another review from about the conductor, emotionally overwhelming. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for Ishmael Reed Sunday matinee. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights for the conductor. $40 to BAI for a pair of tickets. Vanities, a musical with matinee tickets, everyone. We are my fellow Altacacas who want to go to the theater during the day. A new version of Vanities, a musical that my memory of it. Just delightful. We have tickets all this week at the theater at St. Jean's Tuesday through Saturday night at 7:30, matinee on Saturday at 2:30, Sunday at 2:30, and the following Saturday and Sunday at 2:30. So email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. I guess in appropriate fashion, Carly Simon will say goodbye. I'm on Monday at 9, back with you next Saturday at 8. The sun is shining, so take advantage of New York before Trump comes and visits on Tuesday and we all go mad. Carly Simon, let me hear you say goodbye.
You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York, any Saturday on any Sunday with David Rothenberg, came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up at 8 o'clock is City Watch with Jeff Simmons and Carlos Menchaca. So please, stay tuned.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting is on Sunday, March 19th at 1 p.m. And you are invited to attend. The CAB, or CAB, is an advisory board which reviews programming and other station policies. It represents the diverse views and interests of the communities WBAI serves. If you want to attend the meeting, you can join by teleconference at 619-309-1058. And the PIN number is 641-711. Everyone is invited to call in and join the meeting, and we're happy that more people are now attending CAD meetings. Once again, the call-in number is 619-309-1058, and the PIN number 641711. We hope that you'll be able to attend. That's the Community Advisory Board meeting, WBAI, March 19th, Sunday, 1 p.m.
$0.33 a day. Not much, is it? Loose change. A third of a cup of coffee. It's nothing. But did you know that 33 cents a day can help WBAI stay on the air? That's all it takes. As little as 33 cents a day, $10 a month, you can be a BAI buddy. A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a recurring monthly donation to WBAI using either a credit card, debit card, or by electronic fund transfer from your bank account. It's safe, secure, and easy, and it helps keep our unique, alternative, and diverse programming on the air. You'll get a WBAI membership card and other goodies. Sign up online. Go to WBAI.org and click on donate. All the details are right there. The WBAI buddy. Be one today.
Hey, this is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Whoa, whoa, whoa.